Machine Music Podcast. Welcome to Matechet, Machine Music Podcast, your bi-weekly foray into the absurdities of making weird connections between theory and heavy music. I'm Ron Bentovim. I guess I'm a host. I don't know what I am. Thanks for coming back, if you are coming back. Thanks for coming, if you're coming. That sounds inappropriate, but we'll live with that. And great to have you in what is actually the vacant space of my parked car, which is the best available sound booth I have right now. So thanks for being here weirdly with me. Obviously, thank you also to my Patreon patrons for being amazing people, basically. If you want to join the Machine Music Money Train, that actually made me laugh, then you can go to patreon.com/machinemusic and find the best possible way to launch measurable amounts of money toward my being. Thank you. So now that that's out of the way, let's get back to what we were talking about for the last, I don't know, what is it, a month now, more? Which is authenticity. And my insistence on talking about what authenticity means and what are some of its importance, its effects in heavy music, you know, from noise, hardcore, heavy metal, black metal. And like I said at first, you know, these concepts will kind of wear themselves out when I feel like they've done so. I feel there's still meat to this authenticity thing. And so I think we'll do that for a while more, even though I have some ideas about what's coming next. And let's just quickly recap. We began kind of the first two episodes were kind of introduction into what I mean by authenticity in various ways, right? Authenticity being what is it that makes certain types of music sound authentic. In the second episode, I kind of went into the nitty gritty of what that means. I talked about Peirce. I talked about semiotics. Basically, that there are certain elements of music, and I think heavy music is that type of music that accentuates those elements. Sometimes, we'll get to that today, where something feels real because it feels unexpected, violent, jarring, and so on. And that, in a way, when people listen to these types of music, they are, you know, unconsciously and inadvertently, maybe, looking for real things. Last episode was a very special one. Kind of still getting over that. And that was my interview with Ian McKay of Discord Records, Fugazi, Minor Threat, etc., etc. And that was kind of my attempt to kind of tap at, that was a lot of kind of in one sentence. That was my attempt to tap at what it means for an artist to speak of authenticity. I thought Ian was a good choice for an interview for that topic. I still think that's the case, both because he's an artist and he can speak about that, but also because he's an artist who is embedded or very noteworthy within a scene that seems to me, from the outside looking in, I've never been a hardcore scene person. I've never been a scene person in any kind of way, but that also. It seems from the outside like one of those scenes where a reality, authenticity are very important in a certain way, right? And I try to talk about what that way was, or at least what that meant for Ian. And I was kind of surprised. In some ways I wasn't surprised, in some ways I wasn't. So to recap the whole Ian situation, I interviewed him, fucked it up, didn't record it well, and then interviewed him again. Yeah, I know. And during that first interview, he mentions an element which he repeats in the second interview, and the one that actually got published more, but there was something there that I liked about how hardcore was this space for not caring about edifice, not caring about overwroughtness, not caring about what you're supposed to do, not caring about, you know, level of musicianship. You're just supposed to, as he said, play as you are, right? Come as you are. And that I expected. I expected hardcore to be a musical space where stripping stuff down, maintaining an authenticity that is attached to a specific personal reality would be a very important element, right? It isn't glam rock. It isn't, you know, Elton John. It isn't Beyonce. It isn't any one of those artists that, you know, it seems rehearsed. It is rehearsed. It's costumed. There's a lot of persona at work. And hardcore, and Ian, I think, emphasized that point quite well, isn't about that. Hardcore is about not doing that. In a way, hardcore and punk are all, to an extent, reactionary. Like all musical forms or artistic forms, they are, to an extent, a reaction to what came, you know, either before them or during. And that a lot of that reaction is to, you know, stadium rock and, you know, the Led Zeppelin, overwrought, overly ambitious, overly technical brand of popular music or rock specifically. You know, it wasn't rebellious. It wasn't anti-establishment. It wasn't cutting edge. It was just, you know, like a bloated thing. And so all of that I expected. But at toward the end of that very interesting conversation with Ian, something unexpected happened. And that unexpected thing throws us, fortunately or unfortunately, depends on who you're asking, back to the origins of this topic and this podcast to an extent. Because what happened at the end of that was Ian mentioned his mother's side of the family coming from a line of, I guess you could say, kind of like a fundamentalist or a hardline Baptist, who were known as hard shell Baptists, who would have what you would call, in not necessarily super professional theological terms, a personal relationship with God. And Ian mentioned that. I was kind of taken aback, but I was also taken aback, or even more taken aback, by the fact that Ian made the connection I had in my mind when he said that, made it the connection, direct link between that type of theology of spirituality and a type of music that he is a practitioner of, or used to be, that is quite known for being, let's put it this way, kind of not necessarily religious, not necessarily spiritual. And actually, that's one of the things, historically speaking, that has always been fascinating to me about the DC scene and the role, say, Bad Brains had in that scene. And Bad Brain is a deeply spiritual band, deeply ethical band, and also in spiritual terms. And so it was always fascinating to me that that band was as influential as it was, and yet really not a lot of, at least DC hardcore that came after that, was as spiritually influenced. Newark hardcore, I guess, was in a way, because it has that positive, you know, vibe, emphasis on positive vibes. And you actually have bands like 108 who are, you know, explicitly spiritual, or Hare Krishna specifically. But I never expected Ian MacKay to make that comment. And here's the reason why it's an interesting comment. Well, it is an interesting comment, I think, in general, right? To compare and link two forms of saying we don't need the institution to practice whatever it is we're practicing, right? And it's interesting because it links spirituality to a band I didn't necessarily consider to have that in them, not at least immediately. But it's interesting on a personal level, because my own interest in authenticity began through my academic interest in the last few years in the literature of the 18th century and in the, say, political theological history, English specifically, so Britain or England, of the 17th century. And before that in France. And one of the major kind of focal points for me in that study, now to recap, I don't know if people know this or remember, my field is more aligned to kind of contemporary trauma studies, war writing, trauma in writing, and so on. So that's kind of like what I do. But whether or not you're in academia, or ever been in academia, or whiffed academia, you would know that the reality of the profession, as it were, is that you teach a lot of courses you're not, you know, you wouldn't think you would teach, but you just teach them because someone needs to teach that course and you need a job. That's kind of the nitty of gritty. And I had kind of a prior inclination toward Robinson Crusoe and Gulliver's Travels and a lot of literature of the time for different reasons. And I just, you know, I said, fuck it, whatever, I'll do it. And the more I did it, and now I've been doing it for a few years, started teaching courses about it, writing articles about it, I've been finding it more and more interesting. And one of the reasons that era in Western history is interesting is because it really is that moment where it's quite clear that whatever influence, you know, classical learning, the Greeks, the Romans, and whatever influence the Catholic Church and some of its offshoots, such as the Church of England, that is, if you don't know, historically, a kind of hybrid Catholic Protestant church that really isn't all the way Protestant, nor is it all the way Catholic, kind of a weird in between. And so the influence of conservative churches is on serious wane. And the influence, intellectual, theological, political, of what are considered the progressive for then, progressive churches or dissident churches or rebellious churches, what we know now today as the more radical wings of the Protestant church, is on the rise. And that has a lot to do with, this is not going to be a crash course in the history of the 17th century in England, but there was a civil war, and that civil war was won by a specific side, and that victory also brought with it a greater influence, intellectual influence, and so on. And one of the hallmarks of the winners of that side, and one of the hallmarks of the intellectual kind of powerhouse that was on the rise in the English-speaking West and in the French-speaking West, let's add France in there too, is just that idea of tearing down a corrupt, you know, inept, gangrenous, redundant, and hypocritical, and really thieving institution, right? Which is the institution of the Catholic Church, and to an extent, the more conservative wing of the Church of England. We can go back to Luther, you know, what is Protestantism? And Protestantism basically is, you know, taking religion and spirituality and religiosity out of the hands of an establishment that cannot be trusted with it anymore and into a more user-friendly, more individual form of worship. Now, whatever it is that Luther preached is not necessarily that radical as what we're talking about right now in the 16th, 17th century, but is that basic tenet, right? That we are going to return something to its fundamentals, hence fundamentalism, right? That is a very important side of the story. And it's also important in terms of Ian MacKaye, all the way back in the late 20th century, because the most, or some of the most radical forms of that idea take root in the United States. Obviously, for historical reasons, these are people who were chased out of England for having too radical ideas. But United States, its brand of Protestant Christianity is kind of its root is, at least in the Protestant sense, right? There's other churches, obviously, as well. Its root is in quite radical ideas of what religiosity means. And in terms of authenticity, quite radical ideas of what it means to be an authentic believer. And in terms of that form of belief, and tying it again with what Ian mentioned, whether he wanted, you know, to take it and run with it as I'm doing right now, I don't know. I'm probably not, but it is interesting to me. My podcast, Ian, sorry. Punk and its kind of American iteration, which becomes hardcore, was much more, or the American side is much more interested in shedding even the artifice of rebellion to an extent, right? Because when you look at English punk, the English punk movement, it had some trappings, right? There was a costume also involved there. You know, the hair, the pins, the leather jackets, the, you know, the crossed out Union Jack, the political aspect of it. There's obviously an intense desire to bring down, again, it's the same story, right? The corrupt institution of, you know, English class system, monarchy, and so on. And kind of the cry of the proletariat, the cry of the working class. But there's also what may appear as the rise of a new, not church, but a new kind of dress code. And the American side has always been kind of noteworthy to me, and I think to an extent more appealing to me personally, because it seemed like they took it even further by saying, no, we're just dudes. And that's one of the great examples. A story that Ian gave in the deleted, now famously deleted interview, is that he spoke of an anecdote told to him by Jem Cohen. Jem Cohen, if you don't know, is the artistic collaborator with Fugazi. He did the wonderful instrument, kind of semi-documentary about Fugazi. A lot of their album covers, a very talented person. And Jem Cohen was talking about how he met other filmmakers of note, I guess, who were in the music business. And they asked him how Fugazi were, like, as people. And he said they're the same people on stage and off stage. And they were shocked, according to Ian's rendition of Jem's story. They were shocked that, you know, it wasn't an act. That it was even conceivable to have a band go up on stage and be the people that they are and go off stage and be the same people that they just assumed it was a persona. And Ian liked that story because he liked the fact that they were shocked, I think. And he didn't say that specifically, but there was something about his tone. He liked that they were shocked, but it was also kind of a way of him introducing the idea that he thought it was a good thing. It's also mentioned in the interview that was recorded in that quote about Black Flag, where some magazine slash, I think, wrote about Black Flag as looking like dudes who just came off the parking lot, and Ian loved that. Now, all these things are all this anti-aesthetics, right? Anti-establishment, anti-costume, anti-rehearsal, anti, to an extent, skill. All of these things I find magnificently wonderful, as long as we address them, I think, in my mind, as a form of aesthetic, right? As a form of presentation. Because that presentation, and kind of as the proof of that is that that presentation, once stagnated, calcified as a norm, is something that begins to kind of lose its edge already at the mid part and late part of the 1980s. I'm talking about hardcore as a movement, right? Right, this idea that everything has to be pristine starts to get, in other words, a kind of rule book about the correct and incorrect ways of being pristine, or the correct and incorrect way of not giving a fuck about whether your logo is stylized or not. Famous example of that is those shirts that are now making a comeback, because some of these aesthetic affinities are making a comeback, in hardcore at least, of like the tiny, tiny, like the huge oversized shirt with a tiny, tiny, barely stylized logo in the middle, right? Which really is a kind of another form of making the same statement, right? This is something we don't care about. Dressing like we are something we're not is nothing, something we don't care about. And interestingly, and I might add this, actually, let's add this now. I actually spoke about this with Nick McMaster of Kralis, about how, you know, he said Kralis never gave a shit about, you know, the band photo or the kind of the black metal, death metal band photo that had to be super dramatic. They would just show up dressed as they were and not giving a fuck. And I kind of had to force him to see that that was a very American thing. You know, from the outside looking in, I'm not American. From the outside looking in, that is a very American thing, because for me, for my money, a lot of the European scene, and this is a very broad generalization, but a lot of the European scene was, in fact, about the dramatic band photo, the costume, depending where, right? Not necessarily 1991 Napalm Death, but you know, those were the exceptions to the rule. So that's one aspect, right? And this was accentuated by a part of the interview where Ian was annoyed with me for kind of harping on what he considered to be negligible detail about shows he went to that felt real to him. And those examples included Lux Interior vomiting in the middle of the Cramps show, Ian's example of a girl assaulting him, basically, right? Like kissing him against his will mid-show, which is another form of violence. I think it's pretty clear that Ian experienced it as a violent event. And the firecracker being thrown at... in the middle of that concert. I think that he thinks those are negligible because those were not planned part of the show. And for him, it was an example of what he loves in music, that it's unexpected. And I appreciate that and I respect that. I also appreciate his comment about not latching on to extremes. However, I do think it's telling that within the context of a framework of authenticity, in which we're talking about, you know, be yourself, be who you are, don't rehearse, things like that have a special importance. And it's not to say that they are the only thing happening in that show. If the music is horrible, Ted Nugent is the guy's name. If Ted Nugent's music isn't compelling, if the Cramps aren't, you know, one of the greatest bands of all time, and if he wasn't as much into playing the music of Fugazi while, you know, that event with the fan happened, none of that would have mattered. That's granted. But within that church, within that space of authenticity, and within the way in which that space kind of pivots around come as you are, we're not rehearsing, unexpected stuff that happens out of the blue has a force. Now, that force doesn't really need to be articulated or proven here, because I think some part of the proof is that Ian is even talking about these elements, right? Negligible as they are, or at least not central as they are, you know, 40, 30 years on, he's talking about Lux Interior vomiting. So that's one way in which that force is felt. Also, one important thing that is important also in Ian's depiction of hardcore as a come-as-you-are sport or scene, and my kind of draping of the 17th or 16th and 17th and 18th century backdrop on it, is that the body, that uncontrollable thing, that stinky thing, where in some traditional, some would say most traditional societies, is something to be ashamed of, also because it is unbridled, also because it is untamable, right? There's something unexpected about it. There's something profane about the body. The fact that the body is doing the acting out is very important in all of these examples, in the throwing up, in the, you know, near-death experience with firecracker, but also in what begins to rise out of the ashes, or whatever, that was ridiculously weird word choice there, of the 16th and 17th century, which is the importance of, say, the natural sciences, of studying the body. The body is not profane anymore. The body is not a source of shame. The body is a source of science. The bedrock of human sciences is the body, whether it's, is, you know, the body of the person in medical sciences, or the body of nature in the natural sciences, like such in physics, chemistry, which is really that's the stuff that's leading the way in the precursor, you could say, of the Industrial Revolution, which is a scientific revolution. And so, again, it's easy to look at those moments and say, that's negligible, that just happened, but it is very telling that it is happening in a very specific sense. And one way to kind of emphasize how telling it is, or how important it is to shine a light on that other side of authenticity, which we haven't spoken of yet. And I think this episode officially will be the kickoff episode for that mode of authenticity, which is, in one word, the authenticity of mystery, which means that as opposed to the authenticity of direct access, which is the, you know, hardcore Protestant, or at least radical Protestant authenticity of the body, of even in religious terms, which are not, and I completely understand that Ian's terms, but in religious terms, in terms of radical Protestantism, right, to look at the body, to study the rules of nature, is in effect a religious activity, right? The body out of control in its radical sense, like in the Quakers or Shakers, which are two radical Protestant American kind of sects, where, you know, one proves his religiosity, his adherence to God and his, you know, power by losing control over one's body, right? By speaking tongues, things of that nature. The other side of that divide is saying there is no direct access to anything. Yes, there is a source of authenticity. That source is divine. And you have limited access to that source. Now, part of you have limited access to that source is really what set off the Reformation, meaning that's really what set off the counter movement to this religion of mystery, which was really the source, one of the pillars of the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church for centuries, right? Some would say for millennia, because it's still going strong. And so the aesthetics of mystery say, the source of all authenticity is divine, and you are not divine. And the best you can do is learn your place within this divine order, learn your limits as a non-divine entity, right? The limits of your mind, the limits of your worship, the limits of your intellect, these are all, right? The limits of your art, the limits of your music to our conversation, and accept them, right? And you can do a lot of great work, which isn't necessarily ecstatic work. I'm not saying not necessarily, because ecstasy and lack of control have a very interesting role in these traditional kind of aesthetics or aesthetics of authenticity. But those are, I think, exceptions, radical exceptions that don't necessarily prove the rule. So we won't focus on them, not at least now, but maybe later on. But in those terms, right? And it will take it into metal, straight into metal, right? We're dealing with something mysterious here. And so you can strip down all you like.
You can wear a t-shirt all you like, and you can, you know, not play well, the guitar well all you like, and, you know, do $5 shows, basement shows, all you like, but you're not nearing authenticity. You're just, you know, playing along with some specific illusion of nearing authenticity. Because by default, by a rule, authenticity is inaccessible to you, right? To anyone, basically. And so what's left for you to do is perform. That's on the level of religiosity, right? In some conservative, you know, institutions such as the Catholic Church, such as Judaism, such as Islam, no one necessarily cares what you think about when you perform certain rites. You just have to perform them. And the performance has an importance in kind of expressing devotion. But there's no, or there's at least a lot of dispute about whether or not intention is what's being on display. What's on display is the performance itself. And you can get really good at performing. You can get really good at creating an atmosphere of mystery or an atmosphere of limited knowledge without anyone really knowing whether you're the real deal or not. In fact, my favorite, everyone has a favorite Bible story, right? So my favorite Bible kind of anecdote is a confrontation in the Old Testament between a true prophet of God and a false prophet, which, and the ability to distinct between true and false prophets in Judaism is a huge deal. It's fascinatingly a huge deal because there is no cut and dry answer. It's always suspect. And in this specific case, because it was, you know, live, so-called, and God, so-called, was there, and we knew who the narrator was telling us was the true prophet, and we knew that the false prophet was just, you know, lying. It was just a show. The real prophet at the time, this is Jeremiah, thought the show was amazing. In other words, he spoke to God. God told him, go preach to the people. He went, preached to the people, and there was this other guy there called Hananiah who put on a better show. And because he put on the better show, Jeremiah walked away thinking, I guess I must have dreamt something because I'm not the real prophet. He's the real prophet, right? So that story is only to say that there is no bedrock of authenticity in, say, in this context, the Catholic side of the debate. There is an emphasis on limit and an emphasis on mystery. And it's very easy, I think, to see where would that would fall in metal and hardcore, right? And I think one of the easiest things to see is that it would not sit quite well with hardcore. This idea of mystery, this idea of a limited knowledge, not being able to know, this kind of intrinsic, I wouldn't say Gnosticism, but doubt as to the ability to know anything about the truth, that's not really what drives a musical genre, a lot of it of which is centered on exposing the truth, exposing lies, later on in grindcore, you know, exposing the failings of modern civilization and, you know, capitalism and modern politics. Really a lot of it, and this is seeped into the hardcore influenced aspects of metal, such as crossover and thrash, that are really about exposing the truth. Famously, one of the tropes of those, you know, big four thrash interviews about the LA scene in the mid or the beginning of the mid 80s was that everyone hated glam rock and everyone hated, you know, Rat and Motley Crue and Metallica and bands like Megadeth and Slayer and Anthrax in New York were supposed to kind of tear down the curtain and be real, right? Jean jackets were realer. Wearing sneakers were realer. And these guys with the puffed out hair and the colors and all that stuff, they were the image of decadent, you know, superfluous and hypocritical edifice. You know, no one would blame Nikki Sixx of being a Catholic priest, but in a way that's what thrashed in through kind of via the vehicle of punk and Motorhead to an extent, which is also via the vehicle of punk, we're doing. They were exposing the truth. So a mysterious or mystery-led hardcore, at least in the original sense of hardcore in the 80s, that seems almost a confliction in terms. But it's very easy to see where that would sit quite well in modes of metal where mystery is more than welcomed. And I'm obviously talking about, I think the one that jumps, you know, right out is black metal. But I think also some of the modern, more contemporary forms of death metal share that. I think originally, you know, Floridian death metal, despite the fact, you know, that Morbid Angel and Atheist had some kind of lofty ideas, I think a lot of the aesthetic, even in appearance, right? Just dudes, at first at least, dudes playing in cargo shorts and t-shirts, was a hardcore influenced aesthetic. There was a mixing of occult themes there, but there was a lot of that there too. In the contemporary scene, death metal scene, there's a lot of, even if it's ironic at some point, kind of appeals to mystery, you know? My favorite is the, is the merch shot with the skull and bones. And when I say favorite, I say I hate it. Please stop doing that. If you have a band and you're listening to this podcast, which, you know, is a very low chance of that, but don't do that shit. That's ridiculous. Anyway, moving on. So to our less judgmental mode, right? Black metal, in a way, was supposed to be a stripping down as well, right? Because black metal, again, ideologically, musically, deals a lot with stripping back, a reaction to kind of the bloatedness of, surprise, surprise, death metal, a reaction to, ideologically speaking, to, you know, whatever, Scandinavia being forced to convert to Christianity in the 14th century, whatever, right? So these are all correct things to say. And yet black metal is very influenced by the emphasis on mystery in performance. It just isn't necessarily Christian mystery, even though that's not even all the way true, because a lot of these weirdly kind of, whether truly or not truly satanistic bands are, you know, mocking Christian rituals by mimicking them, but really just reproducing the conditions of mystery that they're saying the Christians forced on, whatever. So there's a little repetition going on there. But even if we're not talking about repetition, this idea of taking, you know, for instance, Norway back to a pagan past, pre-Christian past, even though that is a moment of fundamentalism, and there are figures in that scene that are fundamentalist, it's also about celebrating a ritual that it isn't just the ritual that was forced on them. So it's not necessarily secular completely or hardcoreistic in that way, because it is interested in the rites. It is interested in the ceremony, and it is interested in performance, just not the ways in which they feel like they were forced on them, right? Just not in the ways that were fake. Again, there's this authenticity thing coming here again in contemporary Scandinavian society, for instance, right? There's black metal everywhere now, so it's not just Scandinavian black metal, but I think a lot of its power comes from there as well. But I think, so that's easy. And interestingly for me, kind of as someone who's thinking about these things, in the last few years, I've seen a rise in costumes, which, I mean, you could say corpse paint was a costume as well, and that's, you know, granted. But, you know, identity-concealing costumes, not just identity-augmenting, I guess, not just self-empowering, but self-effacing costumes, just such as, obviously, like in a band called like Ghost, or bands like Megwa or Batushka, who are three very different bands, kind of when you think of it. No one thinks Ghost and Megwa play the same music, and no one thinks Batushka and Megwa, even though there's more similarity there, play the same music. There's an interesting kind of common ground in self-effacement, which, if you go back to Ian MacKay, way back in the, you know, the beginning of this recording, podcast, whatever, that's pretty much the complete opposite. Ian MacKay is not saying I'm effacing myself. I'm deleting my identity for the service of my art. He's saying, no, my art is my identity. They're attached. And when Megwa comes up on stage and they all have pseudonames, and when, you know, Ghosts go on stage and they all have, famously, pseudonyms that have to do with the church specifically, I should say. All of these things, that comes from King Diamond as well. I'm not, you know, forgetting that, but, you know, to make that point, all of those things are a return of a certain kind of repressed in the West that hasn't really shown up in radical or in extreme music for a while. Because for a while, in extreme music, to hide your identity wasn't necessarily the David Bowie-ness of extreme music wasn't necessarily always there, because, and here I arrive at the patron saint of the what we're calling now the Catholic or the mysterious source of art, David Bowie, at least in the 20th century, in my eyes at least. He's the most central figure in that aesthetic. David Bowie doesn't care who, if you know who David Bowie really is. That's not the deal. The deal is making compelling art. And this goes back, and for the service, in the service of making compelling art, personas are part of the deal. Because again, we're always limited in our access. We can always just play along, just perform. And so changing personas, which was for a moment in David Bowie's career, you know, cause for derision, right? You're not a authentic artist. You need to remember he's coming out of the 70s. You know, Bob Dylan's in the 70s and the 60s as well. But, you know, there's a lot of authentic art happening. And people, you know, even though his first, you know, foray is Ziggy Stardust, and no one has any doubts that Ziggy Stardust is completely fake, right? And he's not an alien. He's not from Mars. And yet he changes that up into something that looks like, you know, an 80s pop singer, and people were mad, or at least shocked, right? Part of the shock is that, you know, there was something compelling about the performance of Ziggy Stardust, and to throw it away and appear as someone else seems weirdly disingenuous. And I say weirdly because it's an act, right? This is actually, this is maybe a point where I should include part of one of my past interviews for the Albums of the Decade series, and you can read the full interview on the website, a link to it somewhere. And this is with Christopher Rigg, who is a very interesting figure in everything that I've been talking about. Christopher Rigg of Ulver, obviously, the Norwegian experimental band Ulver, that began famously as a black metal band that was very much entrenched in authenticity in that way, right, in the black metal way of ritual, and then broke off from that. That was his Ziggy Stardust movement, or their Ziggy Stardust movement. And again, people were shocked. And then Ulver kind of morphed into a different kind of band, kind of electronic, you know, post-rock band, which shocked people. And then they changed again to kind of a synth pop band, and people were shocked again. And I think at this point, it's safe to say that to be shocked by Ulver is, you know, to expect anything of them is the mistake. But we actually talked about David Bowie, but he also talked about that in terms of authenticity. Because authenticity in this worldview isn't just, you know, it's like, you know, perform the ritual, which is, you know, I think it's safe to say with the black metal aspect of it and death metal aspect of it as well. But it's also make sure you're always performing your most effective mode of performance. And in more modern terms means that kind of translates as only make the art that is interesting for you to make. And if you're always changing, and if you're always making just what's interesting to you, and if sometimes things lose their, you know, attraction, just like I said, you know, once authenticity as a concept in this podcast will lose its attraction, I'll stop doing it. Once that's not interesting to you, once it's not, then it ceases to be effective. It ceases to be good for you. And so you have to change it up, you know. And so in my interview with him, which was a very difficult interview because he's an amazingly talented, intelligent man, but he's not, you know, a person that's easy to interview, because he's wary, I think, of interviews, which, again, is another interesting telltale sign, because he doesn't think interviews can expose anything that's beneficial to his art, right? The truth isn't in whatever random detail I ask him about, you know, whatever happened in the studio and how he writes his songs. And so he's wary of that because he doesn't want it to appear. It's ruining the act. And so I knew that coming into that interview. And so my strategy was not to even appeal to that, but to talk about the way of being authentic while changing, right? And so here are a couple of clips from that interview, and I'll see you after it's done.
It seems that over now, yes, and maybe this has been an ongoing concern from you. I don't know since when, maybe since the beginning, has been resisting this idea of what we've been calling authenticity. And authenticity and the acoustic guitar and the cultural kind of language that speaks to has to do for me, and I think not only for me, with a kind of story. And that story is of a certain linearity, right? So there's a past, one that we can access through history and through legend. And there is a present that is removed from that past. And there's a future toward which we progress. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of basic story to me has a lot to do with the story of authenticity. And I don't think that is your story. And I think the assassination is a radical piece of art because in it, time doesn't work that way. Time is everywhere, right?
That's true.
What's that?
No, that's very true. It's a sort of associative journey through history.
Yeah, and if you're associatively journeying through history, then you're essentially subverting the idea of the authentic time, right?
I get what you're. It's actually quite interesting. you're definitely the first guy to bring these kind of issues up in an interview. It's a sort of. I'm not sure if I'm getting you as I should, but I guess you're hinting at this sort of personal removal of the self.
To an extent, yeah.
Yeah. And I agree. And I think Ulver has always been a bit like that. We're chasing what we sometimes used to refer to as potent images.
Yeah.
And now purely lyrical talk, obviously. And not so much, well, only occasionally using our own life story.
Yeah.
As a source of sorts. That's very true. And interesting. I haven't really thought about it before.
That's what makes assassination so interesting to me, because assassination seems to be the most extreme, not the most extreme, I want to say that, but another version of the extreme attempt to remove the self. And in a way, which ties into what we said about Kiss maybe before, almost kind of flaunting it, right? Because and one of the reasons I've been reading Bowie interviews before this interview is because Bowie got a lot of shit for turning kind of synth pop in the 80s. And
he got a lot of shit many times.
Yeah, he got many. Yeah, that's a fairly accurate assessment. And one of the reasons he got shit for it was, I think, that people, even though people knew that Ziggy Stardust was an act, everyone knew.
Yeah, so, I mean, Ziggy Stardust is the direct, actually. Was the predecessor to Kiss in a way, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it was, and amazingly, it was explicitly an act. No one watching or listening to Ziggy Stardust was thinking they were listening to an actual alien. They knew it was a performance, and yet still, when he moved into that poppy sound, people felt betrayed. Because it was the wrong kind of act. And I think David Bowie, the genius that he was, kind of knew what he was doing with that. And it was his way of saying, as an artist, I get to choose my act.
Exactly.
And simple. What's that?
Really? As simple as that, really.
To the present. Back to my car. That interview, interestingly enough, was not conducted in my car. One of the few that wasn't. So a lot about that. Like we said, for Chris and for artists who are not necessarily aligned with a mode of authenticity that is exposing the truth, only true thing you can do is to express your desires as an artist and to make sure that you are performing those desires in the best possible way, which means that there are technical elements. This is, the nitty-gritty part of this. There will be technical elements involved in the expression of authenticity. Because if you're performing something that is an act, whether it's a musical act or it has to do with also how you physically perform your music, such as with a band like Ghost, for instance, right? To break character or to allow kind of air to filter into the cohesive, organic, complete work of art you're trying to create is to ruin it. Hence the danger in interviews. Hence the danger of repeating yourself ad nauseum or being a boring artist to yourself, right? It ruins it. And this goes back, in a way, and this is my mind just wandering at this point, to, I think I mentioned this. Did I mention it? Who knows? T.S. Eliot. T.S. Eliot is a known artistic conservative. T.S. Eliot is very interested in the tradition. The same tradition that seemingly, people like Ian MacKay or people like the 17th century Protestants are wishing to end, not really thinking that they're establishing a new one, but they're busy ending a certain kind of making something, right? Be it Led Zeppelin or the Church of England. I know that's a weird connection, but whatever. Anyway, back to Eliot. So Eliot says that art, or literature specifically, poetry, isn't just like any other forms of language, just like reading the newspaper or reading the ingredients off a cereal box. It's not the same thing. Even if the same tools are used, right, letters, the effect of what you're doing and the importance of what you're doing is different. And this has to do with his idea of what is the importance of art, the importance of the tradition of art, and with that he is also aligned with other people like Hilda Doodledoo and Ezra Pound. We can talk about this if anyone gives a fuck and some other time. But basically, consuming art, engaging with art, is a living thing. And it's special. It's like magic. And to dissect magic with earthly tools, right, the same way. So if you're really good at writing a newspaper article, and great at reading newspaper articles, that not doesn't necessarily mean you're a great reader of art, right? Which I think is a pretty common complaint among artists of all kinds, musicians, painters, and so on, vis-a-vis their relationship with critics or with, the media. Being proficient in words in a certain avenue doesn't make you proficient in understanding what the importance or the magnitude of the art is. So I guess I just kicked myself. So if what you're doing is different than everyday life, it has to be different in many. And so your aim is to create that difference, create that aura, create that mystery to an extent that is a different world. And if that different world is punctured by reality, which is the worst thing that can puncture it, right? Christopher Rigg isn't really black metal, or is really black metal, etc. Things that have to do with his identity, for instance, or backgrounds to music, and what does this song mean, and so on and so forth. That is just taking the tools of reading everyday life and using them to talk about art, which I think it's safe to say, for people like Christopher Rigg and other people in that realm, blasphemous. Again, I don't think he would talk about it in religious terms, just like I don't think Ian would talk about it in religious terms. But there is a sense of saying the wrong thing in the wrong, an improper thing in the wrong place, right? Shouting out in the middle of the church, ruining the vibe, so-called, if I am to appear to be a millennial. So these are all very kind of fetching things. And what I'd like to end our episode is this idea that not only is tradition and artifice and, you know, rites in their explicit form, like in the band Ghost or in Megua or in Ulver, for different reasons, right? Not only is establishing a persona part of this tradition, I would say, of art, but also a what would be perceived as an extreme disruption of it. And here I mean noise, right? Noise music, in a way, sounds like nothing, sounds like the void or whatever, sounds like noise. And it's taking the idea of distortion, right? That index of distortion we talked about in the second episode, the distortion embodies or places the instrument within a specific context vis-a-vis Peirce's index, and thus emphasizes individuality and realness and authenticity and sloppiness and personhood and all those things that I've been talking about all day long for, you know, whatever. So in that context, noise music is just an exaggeration, further exaggeration of that, right? Distortion isn't doing it anymore. Whatever, growled vocals aren't doing it anymore. Here's us just fucking music up, right? This isn't even music anymore. You're there in your room with headphones on, listening to literally static, a complete defamiliarization, an estrangement of the experience of listening at all to music for your enjoyment, right? So in that way, it seems like it's going on that tangent of exposing the truth of the body, the truth of music, that music is just noise, and et cetera, et cetera. But in other ways, there's something very ecstatic, very limiting to the consciousness about noise music. Because noise music is a limit, right? It's saying to you, whatever is happening right now, you don't understand. It's too much for you, right? There's a threshold for you. And I know this is kind of a counterintuitive way to think about noise music as, say, aligned with black metal or aligned with kind of more ceremonial, more persona involved genres of music, because noise looks kind of hardcore-ish, right? It's a dude in a hoodie hunched over some, like, an electronics board. There's nothing awe-inducing about that. But the effect of the music, in a way, is to defamiliarize or make music so strange to make it unintelligible. And if you can make music unintelligible, that means they can make it inaccessible in that mysterious way as well. One of the artists that has really been fascinating to me in that, this episode is kind of running longer than I expected, so I think I'm going to treat this issue next time with more vigor. But one of the artists that has really kind of emphasized the ritual nature of noise, rock, and all of these contexts is kind of mixed in one salad, even metal to an extent, is Kristen Hayter, aka Lingua Ignota, who I've also interviewed for my art Albums of the Decade project, and I've really focused that interview about all of this. So we really talked about this because I knew she was into that stuff, and I was wondering whether or not she would be interested to talk about them. And in her case, it's even more fascinating because it involves kind of the backgrounds to her music that are of a very real, if you will, authentic experience of violence in her life. And so hers is a moment where these two lines converge into one interesting kind of center that almost sounds like an Altar of Plague song. Never mind. Where complete authenticity is also complete persona and complete hiding. So yeah, that's it. We'll talk about... So next episode is basically going to be Lingua Ignota and some other people that might be interesting to be talking about in that context. Thanks for coming. As usual, I appreciate you. I love you intimately in a very creepy way. I feel we have a good thing going on here. Follow us, me, whatever you want to multiply me. Facebook, Spotify, Instagram, Patreon, like I said, if you want to make me a rich, rich person talking about 17th century theology and, you know, noise music, please feel free to do so. I haven't really figured out what my closing song will be. This is me being authentic, but you'll be hearing it now. See ya.